And now we've got the story of a curse and how Whakapapa unlocked a genetic code which has saved lives. 30 years ago, nurse Mabel Ngāpere McLeod thought there might be a genetic link to the stomach cancer which had cut short the lives of many in her whānau. She took her suspicions to Otago University, and the rest is history. Now, Mabel is Stan Walker's grandmother. The Australian Idol winner was diagnosed with stomach cancer 8 months after his mum was also told that she had the disease, and they both have the CDH1 gene mutation. Now, Mabel is part of the team who took out this year's top Prime Minister's Science Prize for transformative impact. The Hereditary Diffuse Gastric Cancer Team, led by Professor Parry Guilford, Director of the Centre for Translational Cancer Research at the University of Otago, in conjunction with members of the McLeod whānau and their community in Mount Maunganui. Now, the research has resulted in a genetic test which gives people the ability to understand their risk of cancer and take life-saving action. Professor Guilford joined me in the studio along with Mabel McLeod, who put the jigsaw together, and another team member and part of the whānau, Associate Professor Karen Parangatai, also at the University of Otago. So, what does it mean to them to win this prize?
For me, it's really great to have our work acknowledged after so many years trying to change the course of this disease. That's, you know, very exciting. But also, you know, to be pragmatic, it's also we're very, very excited about the prize. We get more money to keep our research going so we can start to work on trying to develop drugs to stop the cancer developing. We work on trying to find more families in New Zealand who carry mutations in this gene. We work on ways to take better care of people who have undergone surgery because of mutations in this gene. So it's really great for us to be able to keep the research going.
What about you, Karen?
Yeah, I mean, I am a gene carrier and I have had the gastrectomy, so I have directly benefited from the work that was spearheaded by these two 25 plus years ago, probably nearly 30 years ago. And so for me, I've come in to this research team in the last 10 years since I had my gastrectomy, to really elevate a Māori voice in this space, and not a scientific voice, not that I'm saying that there's anything wrong with science because I love science, but to elevate our experiences as whānau Māori and to build on the good work that Mabel and Erin at Kamehaora have been doing to make more changes within the healthcare side of things that will make it a better space for Māori to engage in, for whānau Māori to engage in.
And Mabel, what does it mean to you?
Probably the recognition after all these years. I did start 30 years ago and we knew there was a problem. It had been happening for so many years. I actually saw it myself all the way through my life, and then I'd come back from Nelson, finished doing my nursing degree there, and then got this job with a doctor, and it came up that I should look into the stomach cancer, and that's when it started in 94.
And the story in the whānau was that it was a makutu, it was a curse.
It was a makutu that I actually never heard of that story before until then. The story came from outside of the family, and I didn't honestly realise it, that this was placed on the family to do with a hill they said we had sold. We weren't brought up to believe in makutus or anything like that. So I read into it and just that we had sold the hill behind us, which is why we were dying.
But in actual fact, the hill had been taken off them.
Yeah, but we later heard that in 1942 the hill had been taken for the Public Works Act to build the wharf and the roads. And so our people had lived with this curse thing, and all they did was saying in their lives, who's next, who's next, because we have to live with this. But I thought, no, I don't believe in curses. I'd never been brought up like that, so I'm going to tackle this.
So how did your investigation begin, and how did Professor Guilford get involved?
Well, we didn't know where we were going to go with it. We didn't know what the problem was, so we went to the first genes conference in New Zealand, which was here in Wellington, Windy Wellington, and ran into a few people, geneticists, and talked to us about Otago. So I rang Otago. It was like bang, bang, bang.
So when you were brought in, I hear that people thought you were too young.
Oh, I still am. But yeah, that was the thinking at the time. But I'd been working in Paris trying to find genes for human deafness. So I was working with a very early version of the human genetic map, and so I was able to bring all that technology home with me. And so it was good timing as far as I was concerned, and also for the project, because I had all this, you know, cutting-edge knowledge from the French system, and we brought that home to base the research on to do the genetic side.
So how do you go about beginning to untangle something like this?
It starts off with the family. They have to assemble a big family tree, and they have to work out who's had the cancer and who hasn't had the cancer, look at the age that they got sick, and then get us samples, DNA samples, from each of those people. So that varied from blood samples. We even had one Guthrie card from a little baby who, later on, he had died as a young man, but the only DNA we could get from him was his Guthrie card.
So it's a little heel prick test.
As a baby, yeah. And then lots of samples from people who had died of cancer we had to go to, and this is, you know, work that, you know, Maybelle and everybody did in Tauranga. They had to go to the hospital and access old surgical samples, and they were all assembled and sent to us, and we purified out the DNA, and then we had a list of genes we thought were candidates for causing this, and luckily enough, the gene that we found, the CDH1, was reasonably high on our list, and so we're able to kind of match up various DNA markers with the blood samples and the DNA samples, and so you basically have two groups of samples: patients who have, or people who have had the cancer, those who haven't, and then you look for markers which are present in one group and not the other.
So Mabel, when the whānau was beginning down this road of investigation, how did you talk about, how did you have that wānanga, that kōrero about the tissue samples, about giving your DNA? Were people happy to do that?
Well, not at first, because we invited Perry and Tony to the marae, and they had to introduce what they were going to do. So not at first. I don't think it was that easy, because I think they were receptive, but it was the yes word. Let's go ahead and do it. I was ready to do it. I honestly was. I really didn't care. Otherwise, they've been dying. So, but we had old people in there. A lot of this is sensitive. I mean, you think about it. Tissues from their dead loved ones. So they knew that they had to get into this or not, or continue dying.
How did you talk about it? How did you persuade people?
In meetings. Perry and them actually talked about it to them, and they were okay.
They were good.
What was the reception like that you got?
So in the very start, there was a bit of suspicion around us. I mean, because at the time there was quite a bit of distrust or mistrust of genetics and you know, Pākehā researchers and what they were going to do with the DNA, and you know, were they going to do what we hoped that they would do. And so it took a while for the trust to build up. So, you know, so initially I was just a genetics guy, and so why would they trust me? So you know, it was all about trusting the people before you trust the project. So once the trust with me was established, then it started to kind of get a bit easier. People would think, okay, well, these guys seem like reasonable people. They're on the same page. They didn't seem to sense that we wanted to do something different for the DNA. And so we were able to progress, you know, getting samples and getting the research moving. So, but it was the key thing, I think, was getting that trust established early on, and then making it absolutely clear that we had a shared vision for the research. Now, to be careful, we also had a legal contract which underpinned everything, so which defined our various roles in the project, defined what we were aiming to do, who would talk to who, you know, quite a clear structure on how the project should work.
So from your perspective and the whānau perspective, Maybelle, what was it that convinced people, do you think, to get over the line to trust them?
In me. Huh. No, I think probably the contract.
Having that legal framework.
Yes. Once we agreed on that and read it out to them, I think it was a go-ahead from that, wasn't it?
Yeah,
for everyone.
Yeah.
And I think one of the beautiful things about this contract is that the very first point on the contract is about whakapapa.
Yeah.
And that it will remain forever in the ownership of and protection of the McLeod Fund.
Mm. I was going to ask, what was it that you wanted in the contract, the whakapapa?
It was to protect.
Mm.
And I would be the person who would be the liaise between, but protecting was the biggest part. And number one, our whakapapa, our taonga, and everything that we send down to them.
Because this is, it's almost just a story, I suppose, of Western science catching up with the whakapapa, with the knowledge.
Yes.
Because it's there in the genes.
Yeah, definitely.
Karen, for you, tell us about your sort of part in this story and how you came to be to be part of it.
So my dad passed away in 2007 of a heart attack, and we buried him in Invercargill. And so 2 years later, in 2009, we did his kawemate. So we took him spiritually back home to Horowhera, which is about as far east in this country as you can get. And at that hui, my aunties told us of this genetic mutation that was in our whakapapa. And we'd only been alerted to that because of the death of one of my cousins who died in Tauranga. Mm. She'd been looked after by Maybelle and Pauline.
Yeah.
What happened to your cousin? How?
So she died of stomach cancer.
But how old was she?
She was only in her early 30s.
No, she was 20s. In her 20s.
20s. She just had her second baby, so she'd left two babies behind under two.
So young.
Yeah, very young. Yeah. And no one bothered to ask her for her medical histories, I don't think, because if they had, they would have realised that her mother, her sister, had both died of stomach cancer. We suspect her grandmother also died of stomach cancer as well, and they sent her home with reflux after she presented with stomach problems, maybe when her son was 3 months old. So being in Tauranga was the best place, actually. It was a little bit coincidental that once they discovered it was stomach cancer, we were able to get in touch with Kamiho Water, and they helped, I think, ease her into the next part of her life. And then when she died, they also took her home. Well, we were part of the group that took her back to Te Araroas, and then had a meeting with Perry, with the rest of my whānau. And then I think my auntie actually rang me, and I thought, this is weird, because we never had really much conversation with each other. So that was enough to prompt me to go get tested, and then I had my stomach out the following year. And it wasn't until, yes, this gene came along, I had my stomach out, and then I had my kids, and I was like, I need to change the course of history for my kids, and I need to actually, you know, they've both got a 50-50 chance of inheriting this gene.
Yeah.
So I need to make sure that if I, you know, touch wood, die tomorrow, that I've done everything possible to put systems in place and connect them with people, and regularly connect them with people who will be able to help them when it comes time for testing and anything else that follows on from that.
So tell me about the process that you went through before you had your stomach out, where you traced through your whakapapa, and then when you found what was going on.
Yeah, well, I didn't actually know. So when I met with the genetic counsellor, which we know is not really counselling, it's just more like genetic information, communication, they were asking me all those sorts of the questions, like who has had stomach cancer, what age were they? And of course I knew nothing, because that's not the conversations that I grew up having.
Mm.
And we'd only been back a couple of times as an adult, for reasons of death, but nothing related to stomach cancer. So I kind of was just very sketchy. I was like, oh, I've got an auntie who's had breast cancer. I don't know when. It's my dad's sister. No one in our, my dad's descent line, has died of stomach cancer. So it's my grandfather's sister's descent line that that has happened in. So we just kind of thought it happened then, there, in that particular line, and not ours, because no one had died of stomach cancer. But through my research and interviewing and talking more openly with the rest of my whānau about this, because we haven't talked about it much until the last few years, you know, I've got a cousin who's not much older than me who actually went to school with Evelyn and remembers Evelyn's mother just not being there one day and not the next, and being in a hospital in Gisborne, and then all of a sudden they're bringing her back home in the coffin and not knowing what's going on. And so there was a lot of confusion from the ones who lived there, I suspect, especially the kids, because no one talks about illnesses. And
that's the difficulty, isn't it, that you need the information, but so many people, especially if it's something that people are frightened of, people don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. So we made some changes, didn't we, Perry, to the guidelines, where if you just know of one incident of diffuse gastric cancer occurring in whānau, specifically for Māori, then that's enough to warrant getting a test done. And it used to be you had to prove 3 cases, and we recommended an international guidelines that be changed to 1 for Māori.
And so you had the genetic counselling, which, as you say, is not what we think of as counselling elsewhere. When you were told you had the gene, did you have a sense of what you wanted to do straight away? How long did it take you to get to that point of having your stomach out, making that choice?
My sister actually rang me up and she said, oh, I'm negative. I was like, great, the chances of me not having it have increased. I'm like, now I know, that did not change that one iota. But I couldn't make the original appointment. And so I rang up to see if I could either change the date or they could just give me the results over the phone. And they said, no, we prefer to deliver the news to you in person. I was like, I know exactly what they're going to say now.
Yeah.
So I was kind of already semi-prepared for the news to be delivered.
Yes.
And it was on a Friday about lunchtime, and I went back to work afterwards, and it was, happy hour at work. So a bottle of wine was consumed after that, so I can kind of help me process that news. I mean, I met with a surgeon. I was in Dunedin Hospital, and I was his first patient ever that presented with this gene. And so he really didn't know how to treat me, I don't think, and how to kind of talk through some of the things that I was experiencing or thinking about. And so I just said, no, I've got a PhD to do, which was on my dad, and he passed away. And so I needed to emotionally process that first before I could even think of going through something as big as a stomach removal. So he said, I saw him in November, and he said, come and see me again in January and we'll have another chat. Mm-hmm. So that time I took one of my workmates with me, and he said, we talked and talked and talked. I said, no, I still don't want to do this just yet. He said, you do realise there's an 87% chance or an 80% chance of developing stomach cancer. I was like, no, I didn't know that. He said, well, it was in the letter you got sent. And it was this like 5-page letter of just writing. And it came kind of, midway through all that writing. I was like, oh, I didn't realise that. And so from that, the decision got made.
So at this stage, you didn't have a diagnosis of cancer, but you did have the gene. So you were at the high risk of developing it.
Yeah.
Parry, I guess, tell me how this works in terms of the science of it. What does this gene do that allows cancer to flourish?
The gene encodes a protein called E-cadherin, which is involved in holding cells together. And it's also a gene, the protein E-cadherin is involved in how cells orientate themselves in a tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it's gone, when the gene's mutated and the protein's gone, then cells don't hold together the way they should, and they can grow and divide in the wrong direction. And so you can find that you can have some normal stomach tissue, they get some mutation in this gene, and then it will move in the wrong direction and start to sit in the wrong place in the stomach. So it sits out of the little, what's called the epithelial plane, moves somewhere else, a new environment, doesn't get the normal control signals, and just starts to grow and grow and grow from there. So
what is it, though, that means that it can turn into something malignant rather than just continuing as something benign?
We're not totally clear on what makes a... Because everyone who has a mutation in this gene has lots of very small cancers in their stomach. And eventually one or more of those little cancers will become aggressive and really start to move and invade through the wider stomach and then to distant organs as well. So we're not totally certain on what drives it, but certainly additional mutations in other genes are one of the causes to make a cancer go from being, you know, quite indolent and quiet to being very aggressive.
And how fast can that happen?
Well, it's hard to know, but it's probably around about, you know, 1 to 2 years for it to really change gear and start to move.
Mm. Would people have any symptoms? Would people have any indication?
No, generally when the cancer is still curable by surgery, there's no symptoms. When people start to complain of some pain, or, you know, back pain or tummy pain or reflux, then chances are the cancer's got reasonably big and then a cure is highly unlikely.
Okay, so Karen, that's the situation that you were facing.
Mm.
You got to the January. How did you make the decision?
When my colleague said, "You're going to delay surgery, are you an idiot?" And I thought, "No, I'm not an idiot. Don't call me an idiot." And so I just had to figure out when was right. At that stage, I'd had my endoscopy, so I was clear of cancer. But as Perry said, you know, most of us already do have things growing in there. Mm. They just might not have found it. And, you know, at that time, Dunedin Hospital might not have been the best place for me to have had that procedure happen. So at that time, I still had time. I had time to think about when was the right time for me, when was the right time for my family and for work and my PhD and things like that. Mm. So I made that decision and had it done in June.
It's a huge decision.
Mm. It is.
You don't need me to tell you that. What did you want to find out ahead of having that operation? What did you need to know?
Everything.
Yeah.
There's absolutely nothing that was given to me advice on how to live without a stomach. Mm. Get, you know, nutrition is a huge thing. And I only saw a nutritionist after the surgery. And they were not very helpful at all.
That seems extraordinary, that you're having your stomach out and you don't see a nutritionist until afterwards.
Mm, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Whether I could have kids or not, like, that was a huge thing. And then when I did get pregnant, my partner was like, "But how did that happen? Because you don't have a stomach." And I was like, "That's because the reproductive system and the digestive system aren't related."
But I guess
he's going to kill you for telling that story.
But you wouldn't know if your system was, you know, was strong enough or would be able to, you know, grow another human.
And that's exactly what happened. So I was, you know, had extra scans, so fortnightly scans instead of, you know, every so often, and they come at a price.
Mm.
So every scan is $50, or it was when I was pregnant, $50 scans, and I got the fifth one free. So that was quite nice.
Buy four, get one free.
Yeah. Just because, probably the first pregnancy for Dunedin Hospital for someone without a stomach and for this particular reason. So,
really?
Yeah. So extra appointments, obstetricians, you know, food poisoning. I had 2 bouts of food poisoning during that pregnancy. I had gallstones, ended up in hospital, and no one told me that, you know, pregnancy already increases the chance of gallstones. And so no one kind of knew if there was a connection between not having a stomach and bile reflux every single night and then gallstones. So there's lots of things. Emotionally, you know, it would have been nice to have someone to talk to about the kind of emotional roller coaster that would happen, and it did happen, because I say am not a real doctor in the medical sense. So I didn't know that having a hot shower, or having a bath actually, because I really wanted a bath after surgery. So I had a bath and then fainted as soon as I got out because I didn't realise that I had low blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And so no one kind of explained that sort of side of recovery. And
how did you feel emotionally about having such a significant organ out?
Mm.
I mean, there was a lot of emotions going on. Was I doing the right thing? I didn't have cancer in the first place, so why would I put myself through all this kind of trauma? And then, but I did have a niece and a nephew. And I didn't have my own kids at the time, but I had them. And I needed to make sure that I was around for them. And my sister, my little sister. So that was the ultimate goal, the ultimate aim. And I think that's the reason why we're doing all that we can now is it's always for maunga tamariki me ngā mokpuna.
Mai. Mabel, how do people feel? What is the, I guess, the spectrum of emotions, of feelings around having this kind of radical surgery to protect your life?
I don't like it, but I don't know whether there's any other choice. And I've seen people come through unscathed and I've seen people come through it struggling a bit. But the whole thing is that we support them all the way through, right from the beginning, and let them know what is ahead.
Mm.
Prior to even them having their stomachs out, it's not a great thing, but they don't have much choice. They will die. They have asked us, you know, what will happen if we don't get this done? I said, you will die like the rest of everyone, so you have to have it out. And so they're young. You've got to remember these are 16-year-olds.
Mm.
In Tauranga, they're 16-year-old teenagers who aren't even got out there to live properly, and they have to have their stomach out. They have a scope, the endoscopy. If we find that the cancer's there, well, at 16, so be it. And I do feel sorry for them, but I do encourage them.
To have the operation.
To have the operation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's not anything else we could do. So, and they do it. So they grow up, though. In this day and age, their parents bring them up to know that this could be a thing that could happen to them at a young age. And so they grow up knowing. Back in the day, it was put on you.
Mm. I was going to ask you about that, how things have changed over the course of the decades that this investigation and this project has run, because you have new generations that have come up knowing this. So it's a different way of looking at it than, you know, like for Karen not knowing anything, and then all of a sudden you have all these decisions to make.
Yeah.
I guess for the new generation it is not normal, I can't think what the right word is, but it's part of the picture, yeah?
It's part of their picture. Mm. They know that they may have a 50-50 chance of having this gene. They get tested, and if they do, they know that they have to go through surgery on the list. So they've been brought up like that. These people, you've got to remember, to these teenagers today have never seen death like the ones that started with us, that saw their parents dying. So they just, all they're doing is just going by what their parents have brought them up to believe, that they have to one day have their stomach out.
Mm.
And it's just like a computer program in their brain. Well, yes, I've got to have that. Could be 16 or they know that 16 onwards, they have to undergo a surveillance program.
That's one of the things this has been my research for the last 5 years and talking to a lot of the McLeod whānau, and you know, what Mabel's saying is absolutely correct. Those early generations, like say the first 10 years after the gene was discovered, they were the ones who saw so many people die. They had their parents die, their siblings die, you know, multiple cousins and grandparents. And so their reasons for doing it and the emotions behind it was because they didn't get a choice. Those ones who passed away from cancer didn't get a choice, so they're doing it for them. And the younger ones these days are doing it because they want a choice.
Mm.
They want to live, but, yeah, it's a totally different age bracket that we're dealing with. And so there's already a lot of pressures on teenagers, emotional pressures on teenagers, and then we're asking them to go through something really life-changing.
Mm.
And even if they don't choose to have surgery in their teenage years, they're still going to have. All roads are going to eventually lead to a total gastrectomy.
Yeah, Parry, I was going to ask you and bring you in on this. In terms of the treatment of this condition, what are the options? Is there anything other than having your stomach removed?
Yeah, there is an option. So the recommendation is to have a gastrectomy. Mm. But increasingly, that's getting a bit softer because surveillance is getting better. It probably still does mean a gastrectomy down the line somewhere, but more flexibility about choosing when you have that operation. Mm-hmm. So we now think that surveillance is safe for a few years. I mean, the actual risk in any given year is only about 1% of dying of stomach cancer, so it's not too bad. So if someone wants to go for surveillance for 10 years, they can think, well, a 10% risk of a really bad event, that's not too bad. But if we do good surveillance, find the disease early, then that risk is, again, a lot less. So
what is the surveillance?
That is endoscopy. So a tube put down your throat and they look around with a small camera and they're trying to identify any signs of early stage disease. And that's getting a lot better. I mean, the people in Tauranga started off this work and did some really pioneering work in trying to develop methods to observe this cancer early, because it's not like other cancers. And so they did a great job in finding the early signs of this cancer. Imperfect, but still very useful.
What can you see on that test to indicate that there is cancer present?
The most common feature is they call it a pale flat lesion. So rather than the thing you have in your nightmares about a growing tumour mass, this is just an area which is still flat, but rather than being a pink colour, it's just quite pale. And they can be very, very small as well, like a few millimetres in diameter. So very, very hard to see them. But the people who are experienced do a really good job of seeing them. But again, it's imperfect, so if you have endoscopy, you do run a risk of having advanced disease developing. But we think that risk is getting lower, and it really comes down to the individual's appetite for risk. So some people go, oh, like a 0.5% chance in any given year of getting stomach cancer, advanced stomach cancer, sweet, I'm good with that. But other people, especially mothers, obviously, they think, there's no way I'll take any of that risk. I don't want that. I'll do whatever I have to do now to intervene to prevent any risk. But for others, it's that's sweet. I can handle that degree of risk, and we'll talk about it again in a couple of years' time. And I think that's a really important part of this. I think it's very, very important that the decision between gastrectomy and surveillance is tailored to the individual, to both their risk appetite, but also what they got on in their lives at the time. So some people, Karen told a bit about what she was up to, so it was a really bad time to have a gastrectomy. And so we want people to know that, look, you don't need to do it now. If you want to have a family, you want to travel a bit, you want to finish your degree, you want to do whatever you're going to, up to, do that, but make sure you have surveillance from an expert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From a research perspective, how rich was it to be able to have so much material to look at? That, we're talking about how you were able to have access to these records from the past.
That's right.
And to really build that picture.
Yeah. So, there are thousands and thousands of families known worldwide, and I think New Zealand has been over 1,000 tests done in families all over the country, so it's spread way beyond Tauranga. But the knowledge in 25 years ago to try and find genes that cause cancer, the only way was called a linkage analysis, and that required you to have lots of people who have had the gene pass through them, in their family. And you look around the world, there was groups in Portugal looking, there were groups in the UK looking, there were groups in the US looking, they had little families, and this is unusual, we've got a cluster of people with stomach cancer. I wonder what's wrong with them. But they couldn't find it because their families are too small. Not enough information in a small family, say a mother and then one kid and maybe an uncle, not enough information to find a gene in those days. So when these guys present with this huge family, and being Māori, of course, they also knew all the connections. They knew all these distant cousins. You take a Pākehā family, you don't know half your cousins. But they knew them all, and so it was really they're able to pull together this massive, big family tree and show, where we thought the gene must be passing down through those lines. And so that was an incredibly powerful resource and pivotal to finding the gene.
How does it pass? Does it pass through you know, male or female lines, or is it just much more random?
It's just the gene is passed away. 1 in 50% chance of the gene being passed on from whatever parent carries it. So either mum or dad can pass it on.
So, Karen, you got to the point where you made the decision to have your stomach out.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like living after that surgery?
Yeah, the first year and a half was not fun. You know, there's lots of recommendations around eating 6 meals a day. And I think that's what everyone is supposed to be doing, but of course we don't. We're like 3 meals and maybe snacks in between, but probably not.
Mm.
But there was a definite need to make sure that I was eating more often than not. So that was a real big change. And then you just get really sick of food. You get sick of food, you get sick of eating all the time, you get a sore jaw. So it's like, okay, how do we do this? Couldn't eat bread for ages. And, you know, my standard was 2 pieces of Vegemite on toast for breakfast and a cup of tea. And then I couldn't have bread. And I'm like, well, what do I eat instead? And so I was like, okay, half a, you know, one wheat bix, which I hate, but it has 50% of your folate needs, and then increase calcium-enriched milk just to make sure the nutrition, you know, nutrients and things like that were kind of... I had no idea because I didn't have any nutritional advice. I was just finding stuff on the internet from America and going with that.
Because you can eat... So it's really sort of tiny quantities, like you say, half wheat bix.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And even then I'm like, can I push myself to eat more? And so I push myself to eat more and I'm like, oh, I should not have done that. But, you know, like yesterday we got the kids here and they were hungry. It was 1:30, so we just went to McDonald's and I had a whole Big Mac with some chips and a drink. Mm-hmm. So I'm back to some days I'm good, some days I'm not, some days I just... But there's no connection between your head and your stomach anymore to tell you you're hungry. So the good thing is that my stomach never rumbles because I don't have a stomach because... So, but the other thing is, on the flip side, I also don't know if I'm hungry until I turn hangry. And so that's not a good stage to get to.
So what do you have instead of a stomach? What does the operation give you?
Mm.
The stomach comes out. What do you have after that?
Nothing. So, but in time, the next bit of gut down just starts to stretch. The duodenum down that area just starts to stretch and gets big enough to kind of hold a reasonable size meal, but it takes a few years for that to happen.
Wow.
Some surgeons kind of build in a little pocket to it all, but it doesn't really seem to improve recovery time terribly much.
Okay.
Mm. My favourite question, though, that I get asked is, how do you eat?
Yeah.
And I'm like, with my mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's just the same. It's just the same. It's just that, you know, I think your stomach, that my mind boggled when I talked to the surgeon. He said, oh, you know, like, how do you live without one of your most vital organs inside of you? And he said, oh, your stomach's just a big storage pit anyway. It's your intestines that do all the absorption. And so now, you know, my intestines do 2 jobs. It has to break down the food, and then it also has to absorb the nutrients from the food. So because it doesn't have the whole trick to absorb things, because the stomach's not mixing up the food first and breaking it down, that's why we have to eat more often. Yeah.
Okay. But I suppose the theory of it sounds good, but how does it work in the real world, and how does it work where culturally Kai is so significant?
Mm.
Yeah, and that's what we're here now. Good question. It has people have tended to shy away from events, especially in the early beginnings, because you never know how your body's going to react.
Mm.
So going to the marae or going to a big, you know, kind of hakari somewhere, you know, and people expect you to kind of have large quantities and showing just how delicious this kai is, but actually that's just makes you want to throw up, or, you know, makes you want to lie down, or you're going through highs and lows of your blood sugar levels, and so people have tended to kind of retreat socially away from those spaces, and that's not a good thing, because that's how we get our emotional support. And you know, we had lots of conversations with people around the role of kai, and kai is not just about the nutritional factor, but it's the only factor that's been told to us by nutritionists in hospitals these days, or by the surgeons, or by our GPs, that you need to eat this, this, and this. And it's actually, we started to lose the fun factor and the aroha factor that's associated with kai. So the more we talk about it and the more we educate our whānau and have conversations about, oh yeah, that's a good thing to put on the table. Don't give me cakes afterwards. A piece of fruit is good, for dessert. So it's just around about having those conversations. We haven't had those conversations and our voices haven't been heard in any of the publications that have happened about the CDH1 gene and HDGC. So we're on a real mission to change that, to get our voices out there and make it more localised content, I think. There's a lot of stuff from America, but within New Zealand, not so much. It's kind of word of mouth, which is great because that's how, that's Māori society. We always like to talk and talk and talk, and that's how we best disseminate information. But we probably can be a bit more strategic in how we make that more accessible online, knowing that our teenagers don't like to talk, but they will happily scroll through the internet. And so this is a really good thing with this. The prize money is that we're able to think about how we do that better.
Mabel, one of the people that probably a lot of people will know of or will have heard of in this space is your mokopuna, Stan Walker. Mm-hmm. He has done a lot, I think, to raise awareness around this. What do you make of him being so public about his journey?
Before this, he didn't know anything about it until it happened to him. So he was not aware of anything. His mother never said anything to him. She was already under surveillance. And so he had no idea until it really did happen to him. And so he was got on the surveillance and they found his cancer really early, probably on the second or third endoscope that he had. And so he had to go through the motions. He had to go through everything so fast with no knowledge. At that time, he did not know I was involved. When his mother told him how I will be coming over, and he asked, why? Why am I coming in? His mother told him that's where I work.
Karen, how do you talk to your children about it? I know they're little still, but is this something that you do tell them about?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Manuho was two weeks old when we travelled to Wanaka for the
guidelines meeting
to update the international guidelines for management of this, and she was up with me when I was doing the opening address. And so from day dot, she has been at pretty much every event that we've had, every interviews we've done. My son was there as well, because he was only 4 months old when I went back to work and straight back into interviews with the McLeods and the whānau. And so they've both just travelled all around everywhere because they're an integral part of the research. And there's been pushback from the university too about funding and paying for family members. And I'm like, they're not family members, they're research participants. And we have to remember that, this is a community, this is a whānau approach to our own management, and whānau are the best people to respond to pressures that are happening and to respond to things that we're finding out by having these conversations. And then we can got good relationships with Perry, with Jeremy, who's also on this award, this team from Tauranga Hospital, with the genetic counsellors all around the country. So we've got really good relationships with them. And so, what our whānau tell us, what our kids are telling us, what our kids are showing us, not just what they're saying verbally, but what they're doing physically, that informs our conversations with those people so we can make changes in those spaces that are going to be better for them. These kids are not the same as they were as the people going through surgery 25 years ago. They are very different. And we've been, the healthcare approach, the management of it has been a little bit slow to adapt to that.
Just a couple of questions to wrap up. How do you look to the future with this? Because the genetic screening, for example, can now happen in the IVF process. And if that is a route that people choose to take or have to take to have children, talk to me about the difficulties around deciding whether to go through the screening or whether not to, and what risks to run and where the sensitivities lie there?
Yeah, I mean, the people we've talked to, none of them even considered IVF. Mm. They might have little bit thought, should I do this? But a lot of them also had children beforehand.
Mm.
So they're like, well, is it fair for me to now choose the embryos that don't have it? I think in this particular case, it's very different because it's not a death sentence. There's no, you know, with proper kind of management, people can live relatively normal, healthy, fulfilling lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other inherited conditions that aren't so nice to live with. And so it's really, I think, because of our particular gene, it's not something that people are entertaining.
Hmm.
And there's been no stigma against those people either, particularly not within New Zealand, maybe in other countries. But within New Zealand, there's kind of no stigma against people who choose to have babies naturally without doing IVF to eliminate this gene.
Hmm. And Parry, from your perspective, I guess a word on that, but also what is the future look like? What is the next step in this research?
Yep. Just when there are a few Pakeha family who have the CDH1 gene, and they have chosen the IVF route with gene testing, and it's a great call for those individual families. They've thought hard about it, and they've made a decision which is right for them. So it's a personal decision.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we applaud everyone who just gives some thought to it all and makes the right decision for themselves. But the future for us, what we've been working on for quite a while is trying to develop drugs to stop the cancer developing in the first place, and that's come along, you know, really strongly. We've got a lot of candidate drugs we like the look of now, and we're trying to find better ways to deliver those drugs to the stomach, and we're, you know, working our way through various preclinical models, and then we'll hopefully get into some clinical trials in the next couple of years. So, you know, we're really excited about that process because you know, you've heard the stories here how hard the surgery is, and if you choose in the surveillance approach, it comes with a lot of anxiety as well for a lot of people, not everyone, but some people still have a lot of anxiety with that. So we do think if we can find a way to prevent the cancer developing, then we can allow people to keep their stomachs and not, you know, live a life of fear. Further down the line, you know, beyond my time in the lab, there'll be gene therapy will arrive, and the whole thing will just be flipped for people who choose to do that. But it's not really yet, and it'll still be a number of years away before that's even a serious option. But that's probably where it'll end up one day. I know in technology as I do.
That is Professor Parry Guilford of the University of Otago. Also, we were speaking there with Associate Professor Karen Paringatai from Otago University and Maybelle McLeod. They are all part of the team at the Hereditary Diffuse Cancer, Gastric Cancer Team, which has won that Prime Minister's Science Prize for Transformative Impact. And